The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, hello everybody, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. You're listening to the weekly News Dissector Radio Hour here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm here every week at this time, and hopefully you're here with me. You can call in at 888-874-4888. That number again, it's free, by the way, 888-874-4888. And so here we are, another week in the decline of empire, another week of growing confrontation in Washington, polarization and the like. Now the right wing is going after a rapper. Whatever can possibly fuel polarization seems to be what they do. Keep it, manufacture outrage, in the words of John Stewart, and we're seeing this again. So in talking about our politics and talking about the paralysis, the stalemate in Washington, we also have to talk about our own political choices here at home. And we'll be talking about that today, hopefully, with Margaret Flowers, who's a doctor, a Physicians for a National Health Program. She's one of the outspoken people who fought for the public option and for Medicare for all, was arrested right in the hearing room of the United States Senate as she challenged the exclusion of advocates for the public option. So Margaret is supposed to be with us. We haven't reached her yet, but hopefully we will. And in her honor, I want to begin with a song done by my buddy Polarity One, Polar Levine. It's a takeoff on one of the old great songs of America, the Saint James Infirmary. Check it out with different lyrics.
Suppose we look at the problems of a family, perhaps much like yours.
I went down to the St. James Infirmary. 60 people waiting there. It was a cafe. First they handed me a pile of papers. The first page was easy to do. It said, "Who is your health insurer?" I wrote none and turned to page two. They asked me all the same old questions that I answered 20 times before. Didn't they ever hear of computers? And I thought that that's what they were invented for.
Polarity One singing Margaret Flowers, a great version of the St. James Infirmary, a song about people not getting health care in our country, an issue that you've been passionately involved with. I'm so happy that you could join us today. I know we only have a little bit of time. I just want to tell our listeners that in the second half of the program, we'll be speaking with the writer, Deborah Emin, who is not only a writer, but a promoter of getting access to progressive books, is also very engaged in issues of marriage equality and fairness, and she'll be on to talk with us. She's somebody I have a great deal of respect for, and after you hear her, you will too. So we'll be moving on to that. We have a couple of other things planned, but Margaret agreed to come on for a few minutes. She's now a congressional fellow with the Physicians for a National Health Program. Margaret, we first met you, so to speak, when you were being hauled out of a hearing on Capitol Hill. You were a doctor, and you were being grabbed and dragged out. What was happening then, and what put you in that position, which is not a position we see many physicians in?
That's correct. Thank you for having me on today, Danny. Well, this was back in May of 2009, and I was part with Physicians for National Health Program of a coalition of organizations that were meeting with members of Congress to ask them that as they move forward in the healthcare debate, that they include single-payer advocates and that they compare the legislation that they put together to single-payer legislation in terms of how many people are covered and the cost. And when it got time for the initial hearings, which were held in the Senate Finance Committee, we looked at who was invited to testify, and it was all industry people. The people that they call stakeholders are the people that are profiting off of the current situation, and nobody representing single payers. So when we asked to be included, we had people calling in and sending emails. They refused to let anybody testify. So 8 of us went down there that day, 3 of us are doctors, and stood up during the committee hearing and asked why we weren't being included. And for that, we were each arrested.
Well, that's sort of a badge of honor in my mind. But, Margaret, I mean, you know, this was the main issue, in a way, of the whole Obama candidacy. You know, health care, it became his first big priority. And he basically suggested he was for a public option as a way, really, to keep the insurance industry honest and introduce some competition into insurance pricing, I believe. And, you know, and then what happened? How did it get to the point that it did, and where are we now?
Well, you know, now we know it was a ruse, and we suspected that back in March of 2009, when even Senator Baucus was admitting in public that the public option was a bargaining chip they were planning to use during the health reform debate. The public option became a wonderful way to divide those who support health reform and had us arguing about which was better, a public option or single payer, rather than uniting and really fighting for effective reform. It was just very disappointing, even given that the president, coming from Illinois, where he was neighbors with one of our co-founders, Dr. Quentin Young, and had, you know, said that health care was a human right, and the president had even supported single payer.
Let me just say something, because I know Dr. Clinton Young, and I know his daughters. This man was a fighter, the fighter,
yes.
For civil rights, for human rights. I mean, impressive,
right.
Okay?
Yeah,
he was kind of betrayed here, wasn't he?
Right. And so, you know, I think the health reform process was just a really a poster child of what the current situation is with the corporate control of our political process. And that's why, as you know, I moved in. I continue to advocate strongly for single payer and travel and speak about that. But I am also moving into more of a resistance mode and really calling for the need for us all to come together. You know, this is really, health is not just about access to health care. It's about education and jobs and clean environment, all these issues that are related. And we do really need to come together, because our common obstacle is this corporate control of our political process. So how do we shift that power so that we can start meeting our human needs here in this country?
Well, you know, one of the things that Paul Krugman writes about today in a column called Seniors, Guns, and Money in the New York Times is how the great bulk of federal spending that isn't defense-related or interest on the debt goes to Social Security programs specifically to serve seniors. And while Medicaid was once thought of as a poverty program, these days it's largely about providing nursing care, with about two-thirds of its spending now going to the elderly and or disabled. By his count, seniors accounted one way or another for about half of federal spending. So if you cut these programs, you are basically shortening the lives, you know, of senior citizens who are not going to get the health care they need. And ironically, this is from the party that was yammering on about death panels and all the rest of this, upholding, you know, the rights of people to health care and to, you know, as long as possible. Now they seem to have changed their minds.
Absolutely. I just came from a meeting in Congressman Grijalva's office, and in Arizona, they're getting ready to kick 200,000 people off of Medicaid. And the staffer who I met with was in Arizona and at some of these long-term care facilities for seniors, where she was told that they're basically going to have to close their doors, that they can't keep their doors open. They're already running on such a tight margin that if these Medicaid cuts go through, they'll close their doors. Where are these seniors going to go?
So basically, this is like triage city or triage country, where, you know, the idea of a triage is like if there's a big accident, you look at the various accident victims, you decide who can be helped, what the priorities are. Here, basically, we're throwing overboard a whole generation of people who paid into these programs. It wasn't like this is somebody giving them something for nothing. They've all paid in with from their work over all these years. I mean, this is what's so shocking about it. It's like stealing from people directly, and not only that, betraying the promise that we've made for health care. And it seems to be so central, you know, to a decent society, and yet, you know, once you get into the fog of numbers and, you know, deficit doo-doo, you know, it's hard to, like, figure out that there are human beings there.
Right, that's the problem, is that they don't see the human face of this, but it's absolutely there. And as you know, right now in this country, the public is being told the wrong story. We're being told that we have this huge deficit problem and that we have to cut our social programs. It's absolutely ridiculous. We don't need to cut our social programs at all. We can increase revenue to address this budget deficit issue.
Oh, my God. Increase revenue. Margaret, are you intimating, suggesting, implying, you know, inching towards the idea that maybe taxes on the wealthy could be increased a little bit?
Taxes on the wealthy, and let's start taxing the corporations. Why are they getting $1 billion of tax refunds? Why are they hiding their assets out of the country? This is, you know, they're stealing from the American people, and we need to end that. These are our social needs that we're talking about now. These are our requirements.
I have a word for that called plunder. You know, they are plundering, you know,
absolutely,
the wealth of the country. And this is sort of a shocking thing. And, you know, it seems to me, you know, you went from being this, I assume, I don't know you personally, but, you know, assuming a well-motivated physician trying to help people, and then you got caught up in this ugly political process, and now you're still somehow have the fortitude, the stomach, the, you know, the ability to actually go into the halls of Congress, you know, and actually talk to the people in there. What are you finding? How do you manage to do it on a personal level, just to look at people who, you know they're lying when their lips start moving?
Right, right. Well, you know, I have to find a balance between my work outside of Congress and meeting with members of Congress. But we do still need to keep those ties with members who are, you know, willing to speak with us and help us, have us educate them. But that's not going to be the solution. We're not going to change things until we build the numbers on the outside and we have this solidarity of coming together and really being vocal. We're the vocal majority. The majority of Americans want tax cuts on the wealthy. They want to end the wars. They want to expand our social programs, but we need to come together and be much louder about it. Or,
I think what you're
saying, all the work that I do talking in Congress is going to do nothing.
I think what you're saying is really important, and it's really, I think, the biggest, if you will, shortcoming, criticism, failure of the Obama administration. That is to say, it came to power through what I would call the outside game, including people who had never been included. You know, in the voting process, getting more people to vote, getting, building, you know, in essence, an electoral movement for change. And as soon as they got into the White House, they abandoned it and moved into the inside game, you know, kind of dealing, wheeling and dealing on the Hill, quote, getting something done with, you know, people who are in the pay of lobbyists and special interests.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then the administration used the people that they had gathered and brought together during that campaign to become kind of their messengers. So, you know, for example, that, you know, Doctors for America, which came out of Doctors for Obama, they were the ones that were put up for photo ops with the president of, you know, how great the health reform bill was. When I talked to those individual doctors, and that wasn't what they really wanted. They really wanted single payer, but they were just kind of used by the administration.
So when you're in the seaminess of politics and the actual sleaze of it all, what have you learned from that? I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a learning curve. You know, you go in with great hope to make change. You believe in the facts and the arguments, and then slowly that gets eroded somehow, right? I mean, slowly you begin to say, wait a minute, why aren't they listening? Wait a minute, why aren't, you know, the facts say this and they say something else? How is that possible?
Right. Yeah, it's absolutely, I've learned it's not about the facts, it's not about policy, it's all the political game, and right now it's the corporations that are winning. They have the most influence. And so, you know, the things that I took away and my learning points from the last health reform process is that We have to be independent of political party. We have to be willing to push on whatever member of Congress. We have to be clear about what we're speaking about, because they use the language so craftily. They call the Affordable Care Act universal. It's not universal. They call it affordable. It's not affordable. So we have to be clear, and we have to be uncompromising.
We have two word meddling specialists in the studio here today who are very aware of how language can be, used and misused. But talk to you about finally here, because I know you have to go, and I wanted you on the show so badly because I admire your courage and your leadership on this issue so much. Is that, like many people, I had Chris Hedges here, a journalist in the studio, and he's basically saying, like, we have to move into a civil disobedience mode. We have to challenge power and be willing, if necessary, to go to jail for our beliefs. So it seems like a lot of people are coming to that view.
Right,
and you are an old jailbird by now.
Yes, I was arrested with Chris out in front of the White House back in December, and he participated in our recent action in New York City on April 15th against Bank of America. This is absolutely the direction we need to move into, is willing to be put our bodies out there to push on, this corporate machine and try to weaken their power and shift some power in our direction. So I know that we're in the early stages of planning some events in Washington, D.C. this fall, and I hope your listeners will keep their ears
open. Okay, well, Margaret, we want to be on the front of the line here when it comes to this battle. We want you to come back on when there's an announcement to be made so that you can actually reach out to people. You're very persuasive, and you're also a person, like a real person, which is like so unusual. You're not like a soundbite machine. You're somebody who actually has passion. You actually have personal experience. You actually care. You put your, work and life on the line, and we have to admire that. So thank you, Margaret, for coming on with us today. You're one of the people who really, is pointing the way towards the kind of fight we need to have. So thank you very much, Margaret Flowers, for joining us briefly. Next time we'll make it a little longer and more substantive. Thank you. Okay, so
thank you so much.
Well, I'm coming at all this as a journalist, I'm as a media person, and it's my belief, that unless the media at least raises some of these issues, at least discusses some of these issues, at least offers some sort of critique and some sort of criticism, we're not going to get anywhere. All of these issues are ultimately media problems too. That's why I've been editing or trying to the media channel, which is down right now, but we're trying to relaunch it in a nicer format. Sherry Welch, who couldn't join us today, is leading that effort to retool the media channel, because we believe that every issue, no matter what your issue is, media is part of it. It has to be, and that you have to relate to it. So the other day, I was at home going through a box of old CDs with the Green Arrow DJ here on my left. The two of us, looking through all this detritus of my life and career, and I came across a CD that I did in 2005 when I wrote a little book about the death of media, and I wanted to share it with you now. It's called it's a rant, it's a media mandate. Here it is, and then we'll come back in the second half of the program with Deborah Emin and with your calls, hopefully at 874-4888. 888 is the number to call. Thank you.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a
minute. 47 stations carried no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Your attention, please.
Communication breakdown.
This is your news dissector, Danny Schechter, for the Urgency Broadcasting Corporation with an info anti-mercial. The title, Our Mandate, Making Media Matter, from the book, What We Do Now. It's 2005. How do we stay alive? We're so tired of jive. knowing that whatever goes up will one day come down, or that Nixon fell just months after he was swept back into office, no longer reassures. What seemed clear when the challenger conceded, prematurely many felt, was that even if he had won, the fight would have only begun. He was up against more than one man and his Carl roving machine, but rather, as the late reggae original Peter Tosh put it, he was fighting the shitstorm. We all are. As the bombs fell on the Mesopotamian birthplace of world culture, as another election bit the dust, we, many of us anyway, are hell-shocked and worse.
Fox News, ABC News, CBS,
CNN.
Alas, the last place to find out what's really happening is in the places that are supposed to tell us.
Countless celebrity guests.
And even they admit it.
Wager scandal.
The Washington Post and the New York Times both apologized for their pro-war coverage. Mea culpa. And now the network presidents join them. Said ABC's news chief David Westin, simply stated, we let down the American people. Simply stated, never mind the Iraqi people. They've been put down in an occupation designed to ensure their liberation. Our ombudsmen now need ombudsmen. Where did our democracy go? It became a mediocracy when we weren't looking.
We'll be back with more
right after this.
With political candidates spending most of their time raising money to buy time on a media that often shut them out. As issue-oriented coverage shrunk and the press corps did a slam dunk. The result? Bushification, not illumination. Why are the institutions envisioned and protected as tools for strengthening democracy undermining it? Another musician, Pilar Lovin, for his band Polarity One, gets it in the way artists can and politicians don't. He asks, who owns the media? Who does it speak for? Your butt on the sofa, leave your mind at the door. And that's what entertainment is for. It's the drug of the century, the soul's penitentiary. And at its heart and in its entrails, it is our media system that flattens our debates, distorts our perceptions, corrupts our language, narrows our alternatives, limits our understanding, even as it massages and entertains our brains, always reflecting the commercial and political agenda of those on high.
Have a nice day.
Have a great day.
But first, these messages.
We are one nation under television, swimming, drowning in the digital stream, emailing ourselves to death, connecting through cell phones, camera phones, walkie-talkies, pagers, PDAs, and all the new toys in time for the holiday shopping season. We have a Verizon on the horizon, more means of communication than of imagination. We are talking, but are we listening to the drumbeats of homeland insecurity, to the Patriot Acts that are anything but? We are yakking away, but what do we have to say? What is there to say that has not been said?
Do the critics have at least a point?
One set of images flashes in as the others flash out.
Headline hit parade.
The world.
One minute it's Florida, the next Fallujah, all a nonstop collage that makes everything look, feel, and seem like everything else. Oh, beautiful for our new digital channels and TiVo machines, for CNN outfoxing Fox, and kids glued to news from comedy channels. We hear, but are we heard? We live through our remote controls without realizing how remote is our own control. As we choose between the choices we are given, it's tempting to spew prose that oozes because it's hard to get a fix on dangerous times.
Helps protect against germs.
To lock in on our fear of the fear machine. Are we moving back towards the goose step era or forward beyond the Enron era? Is it progress or regress? Or do we know? We do know that it's not working for us. This military, media, industrial, post-traumatic stress complex, driven by a terror war that is not working, period. But it's also driven by dollops of dollars and has momentum, that big Mo thing that's so hard to derail because it not only works on us from outside, but more subtly from inside, through the constant retelling of narratives embedded in our mythologies and dream worlds of what we think our country is all about. It helps us think ourselves to sleep. It is this theme of themes that builds the bubble we live in, that neutralizes unwelcome facts and reinforces those cliches of conformity and cultural understandings that harden partisan attitudes. It is that theme pounded into us that makes us believers, say amen, in the idea that God, yes, God, is blessing America and all will be okay tomorrow when the sun shines and we get up to do it again. So what do we do now? Again, Polarity One. The press is supposed to educate, cast light on the snake, not force feed the cake. But the state of the press is a crime. It's fake. 500 channels, no reason to rejoice. We have too much choice, not enough voice. For one thing, it cannot be one thing. There are too many of us who are angry and estranged, too much to set right, too many levers to pull and changes to be made. And alas, those are not changes we can simply vote for on one morning, on one ballot, and the birds will sing again. History never happens that way. Just look at our history, from Frederick Douglass, who told us power concedes nothing without a demand, to Martin Luther King Jr., who showed us we would have to make the change we want to see, to Nelson Mandela and so many other heroes who show us it can be done. Change comes from below, not above, from the outside in, not the inside out. If only our movements would start moving not just on, but over the obstacles in our way. And those obstacles include the idea that a party or a person can be our white knight in armor. But there are places to begin, to find the path out of here, as another song once put it. I'm a media maven, and so that's where my energy is going. How can you have any kind of democracy if the people are being underinformed and uninformed by a system that dumbs it down when we need it to smarten us up? I'm convinced we can't fix America without fixing the media system, loosening media concentration, strengthening diversity of perspective, promoting media literacy education, building independent media outlets, and challenging the phlegm of the mighty MSM with some of our own. Issues are not issues unless and until they are on TV. TV or not to be? That is the question. I am doing my bit, feeling often like a perpetual motion machine. Media channeling, blogging online every morning, dissecting news and offering views in some rerun of that old speak truth to power routine. By the afternoon, I've shifted into a filmmaking mode or become a marketing maestro, meeting with activists who are working to lobby more effectively and to challenge the templates that keep us locked in place. My hope is to get everyone I can reach, teach, and website range to see that they can get involved in making media matter, in working on media issues where we live and where we think. When will we learn that culture drives politics, not the other way around? I joined the media 30 years ago to spotlight the problems of the world and discovered that the media is one of them, although often unrecognized as such. The last place to look for an understanding of how media works is in the media itself. Unless you can decode the code, read between the lines, deconstruct the packaging, and laugh at the ads.
Fair, balanced, and unafraid.
We have purchasing power. Do we use it? We can say no. Do we say it? Do we feedback and talk back? Is our cultural environment just as important to us as our physical environment? Do we act to defend it? You can vote with your eyeballs and with your ears as well as your ballot. You can demand more than you're getting. To find out what they don't tell us, visit specialized websites like ourmediachannel.org, a super site featuring media critics from hundreds of news organizations worldwide. Enroll in our Media for Democracy Network, a MoveOn.org on the media, organizing actions on media-related issues. Add your input to the fight for better output. Can we put the public back in public broadcasting with more than just our pledge dollars, which are taken for granted anyway? Political appointees to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting,
the Corporation for Public Broadcasting,
the agency established by Congress to shield public broadcasting from political pressure, have gained power and are now affecting programming.
PBS viewers like you.
PBS Tucker Carlson does.
Thank you.
When Bill Moyers left the arena and human rights was long ago deemed an insufficient organizing principle for a TV series. Human rights? Can we take a stand on media issues like those 3 million Americans did by flooding the FCC with letters protesting the relaxing of ownership rules so that more moguls can merge? That grassroots outpouring shocked the media and with the help of the courts slowed down the process towards even greater consolidation, but only slowed it down. To stop it for good, we all need to get it. Get why media matters. Do you know that we are not alone? Few surveys survey our attitudes towards media, but when they do, they show a consensus of complaint. 70% dissatisfaction with those who say they're only giving us what we want. 70% for different reasons, of course, but what else can 70% of Americans agree on? And by the by, when the same questions are put to people in the media, 70% of them, of us, agree the system is dysfunctional, broken, doing far more harm than good. I read the news about the news today. Oh boy. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector of MediaChannel.org, reading from the book What We Do Now, published by Melville House.
We now resume our regular programming.
News news, what we need to know. News news, what we want to know. We've got news news, what we think we know. Government control to choose the show, but the more we...
the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art is life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cummings.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
John Rappaport. Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, The John Rappaport Show.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also
Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here in the second half of the News Dissector Radio Hour, heard every week at this time on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The number here, 888-874-4888. We're going to be meeting with Deborah Emin, a writer, publisher, and activist in a minute. But first, we just want to comment on a few things. First, the media mandates rant that you just heard is online, and you can access it yourself at tinyurl.com/media mandate. If you want to, it'll also be, of course, on the URL, the podcast of this particular show, which we will post on my blog, and also, all of a sudden my voice went, we will post it. Also on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. It'll be on iTunes, and you can tell your friends about it if you liked it, to pass it on. So I'm just trying to find ways to express ideas that might be a little different. Now, this week, You know that we had finally the first conviction of a hedge fund billionaire in Brooklyn, where a jury actually got to hear the evidence, and they heard the evidence in detail, charges of insider trading and charges of conspiracy. So that was very important. Also, I just want to tell you one thing. Opening up at the Angelica and at the Beekman this Friday here in New York is a film called The First Grader. The First Grader is the story of an 84-year-old man in Kenya who insisted on getting educated when the government announced free education for the people. He had been a fighter in the Mau Mau against the British. And he went to a school. He was turned away, but he kept coming back. And it's his story of an 84-year-old man's fight for education and how he interacts with these children. If you saw Waiting for Superman, which was a big, you know, kind of sales job for charter schools, you'll find this to be a lot more inspiring because it's really a film about the importance of education. And it's important because here in New York City, between 4,000 and 5,000 teachers may soon be fired. And these are the youngest people who have just, you know, been educated. So to become teachers and join the public school system, Bloomberg has announced plans to cut them. This will deeply affect the education of children in the city. So The First Grader is the movie to see. It's about Africa. My good friend Anand Singh in South Africa was, you know, part of the team that made this film. And I think you'll find it really fascinating and, you know, teary as I did when I saw it a few weeks back. So The First Grader has opened. Now, let's move on to our guest, Deborah Emin. Deborah, you are somebody who I've been in correspondence with. We've argued, we've fought, we've disagreed, we've agreed, and yet I have a tremendous amount of admiration for you as somebody who is a writer, a publisher of a small press. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, Sullivan Street Press started in 2008 due to a number of serious problems with the publishing industry. And I think anybody who follows this story knows, as Danny, you know, talks about the media, publishing is part of the media, and the mergers and the acquisitions and then the closing of bookstores and the kind of, I would call it a catastrophe that's occurred in publishing was one of the reasons I decided to start a small press. It was an e-book publisher only. And this was for environmental reasons as well as financial reasons. If you ever have had the fortune or misfortune of publishing your own book and seeing the whole process in a bound book format, what you learn is we destroy land, we destroy the air, we destroy trees, we destroy all kinds of our natural resources in order to maintain a world of bound books. Now, I have to tell you, I have a house that's filled with books. I'm not somebody who, you know, never bought a book because I think this is wrong.
Did you coin the phrase bookie?
Yes, I did. The bookie comes from another aspect of what we do. It's called the Itinerant Book Show, which I'll get to because I think it's important to understand Sullivan Street Press isn't opposed to whatever people who are in publishing want to be doing, especially writers who need to get their work out. Danny, for example, has an incredible library of books himself. They're brilliant books. So how do
nobody knows?
Well, well, there you go. And so what do we do as a publisher? We've done something that other publishers don't do. We distribute other publishers' books. And we distribute bound books through this Itinerant Book Show where I travel around as best I can and as often as I can, and I sell in non-bookstore venues, galleries, jewelry stores, people's homes, coffee shops, anywhere that churches, anywhere that people will invite us. We come in, I come in, and I give them a long spiel, and I make them listen to why e-books are important, and then I sell them bound books. Because these bookstores, I mean, there are towns of 100,000 people in this country that don't have one bookstore. Can you imagine how is democracy going to survive if the only way people can get books is by ordering through Amazon? And Amazon is, as far as you know, my company is concerned, not the prime mover and shaker for what we need to have happen in terms of democracy, especially for the community of readers and writers.
What kind of response do you get from people who meet you in these kind of unusual locales and venues, and there you are from, you know, New York City with all these books and talking them up to them?
Well, we get a lot of wonderful responses in the beginning, because people, I mean, this is in 2008, people weren't all that keen about ebooks yet. I mean, they were just beginning to buy the Kindle. The Nook wasn't introduced yet. So there were things going on that people were just beginning to bite. So look how short a time this has been, Danny. We show up with books like yours and David Swanson's and Max Blumenthal's and my books and poets and fiction writers. I read from them, I talk about them, and I sell them, and they're thrilled. Nobody pays attention like this. The other side of the coin is the media in these locales are not particularly thrilled with our appearance. They don't support us. They don't get in touch with us. We reach out. We ask them to come and do an article.
That's because you're not buying advertising in their papers.
Absolutely not.
You know, and that's part of it. That seems to be what happens. The same way in the movie business, you know, you get reviewed if you're, you know, in theaters which are buying, you know, ads in the newspaper. Then you get, you know, kind of a review. If it's released on DVD or released in another way, it's less likely that you will get a review. And this is my experience with many films that I've made, some of which have been, you know, reviewed, and a lot of which have been ignored, including my recent one, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, plunderthecrimeofourtime.com, which is about, you know, the financial crisis as a crime story. HBO is about to have a docudrama on called Too Big to Fail, with a conventional analysis of the financial crisis, not with a criminal analysis.
Well, we showed it in my neighborhood. As you know, we couldn't come because you were off in some Al Jazeera great, you know, talk you were giving. But we showed it in our reading series, and people were blown away. And it is an amazing film, and it's frightening, and it's real, and it's not a
bunch. Yeah, we had a screening the other day in a senior center here in New York that the MoveOn Council, actually sponsored, and I was surprised. It was packed. It was very diverse in terms of ages that came to it. Nobody left, really. They stayed and watched it. And it shows you that if you can find venues, if you can distribute this, if you can promote it, people will respond, but they have to know about it. And this is the problem. You don't have the marketing money. You know, my daughter works in Hollywood, where half the money on any given film goes for marketing, half for making. You know, with independence, 150% goes to making, money you don't even have, and then there's nothing left over for marketing. So anyway, joining us on the phone from Atlanta, Georgia, is none other than the Peach World, is none other than a peach in my world, who I still haven't met personally, but who is a fantastic editor, web developer, and a disciplinarian of yours truly, Sherry the Dissectress Welch. Hi, Sherry.
Yeah, disciplining you's like herding cats. So, Miss Deborah, congratulations on your Sullivan Street Press new redesign of your website.
Thank you.
The purpose of my call is to find out how I can come on board and be a bookie, having lived in Vegas for 5 years. You got my attention.
I am. That's a good segue. Actually, anybody can be a bookie who wants to set up in their communities an agreement with a number of small presses where you take your books, the books on consignment, and you sell them to the people within your community. You support the local writers. You interact with them. And it's a kind of commission-based industry that a lot of former booksellers have talked to us about but aren't willing to do, for the reasons that this is not a high-margin business. But it's a business that promotes books that won't ever be in the bookstores in large enough quantities for people to find out about.
Yeah. Let me just point out to you that the bookstores themselves are shrinking away, with Borders closing a bunch of stores here in New York, and Barnes & Noble closing its big Lincoln Center store and many others. Part of this whole goes back, by the way, to the way in which investors put money into the expansion of these companies on the hope of making a fortune doing it. You know,
Barnes & Noble was a privately held company, and they decided to go public. And when they decided to go public was also at the time that the real estate boom was happening. And this whole marketing idea that you put one of these major stores every 5 feet from each other. And they can't support that. I mean, if you go into the mega stores these days, if you find five customers, you're lucky.
Yeah, but not only that. I mean, you know, we're in a situation where people do not have the disposable money that they once had to go in and spend $25 or more on a book.
They do deep discounting these days. It isn't, you know, my feeling about selling books isn't that it's about money at this moment, because you can buy almost anything you want, either for a very little money and some of it's free. The point isn't that. The point isn't that we don't, is that people don't have a lot of money. The point is that people don't communicate with each other about books, which is why being a bookie is an important part of any community's literary culture, as far as, you know, my personal bias.
And literary culture is part of, very much part of our culture. And when that goes, you know, our culture is eroded. And you know, it's something that is very difficult. I mean, I've written 11 books now, and, you know, I can't say I'm sorry that I did, but I do feel, you know, that I work with a lot of independent companies and well-motivated people who just don't get the breaks. They don't get the books in the stores. They don't get them visibly displayed. They don't get them the advertising. You know, it's not, this is a situation where it's not that people don't want it. People want, if you can't tell them that it's there, they're not going to buy it. So
I agree, but I think the way in which the marketing of books has changed radically is so interesting and exciting and opens up possibilities that weren't there 2 years ago. And I don't think it's the end of books, and I don't think we can talk about a dead book culture. I think we have to be open to what's changing and the possibilities of that change to affect how everybody spends their time reading.
I don't want to just talk about books. I want to talk about your writing
as
well. I mean, you've written, you know, something that's very hard to do, to get into the mind of a child and write about that, you know, as an adult, you know, and to try to make that a credible presentation. Tell us about your writing.
Well, I'm working currently on a series of four stories. It starts with the Skaggs at Seven, who, as Danny has heard me read from, and he owns the book, is the story of Skaggs told in a first-person, present-tense narrative about a 7-year-old Skaggs growing up over the summer of her, you know, summer vacation. And the idea was to present the story so that as imaginatively as possible, one returns to being 7 years old. The difference being a 7-year-old can't know things that an adult knows. So you have to learn how to say what a 7-year-old would know, and it also at the same time imply what the adult wants the reader to know about that life. And then the next volume is Skaggs.
Well, don't assume that because we're, you know, older in this room, you know, we're necessarily beyond the age of 7, you know. Go ahead.
But I mean, I think one of the things that was so startling to me when some people had finished reading Skaggs at 7 was they didn't get that she was 7. They really thought that this was an older person, you know, trying to just impersonate a 7-year-old, not tell the story from a 7-year-old's point of view. So they questioned certain things that happened in the book as to why she didn't do certain things, which she couldn't have done. She's 7 years old. So now that the next volume, which comes out in September, is Skaggs at 18. I'm not 18 anymore either. But, you know, you find a way to tell a story so that the story itself takes you, the writer, over. And that's what happened with Skaggs at 7. That's what's happening with Skaggs at 18. And the next volume after that is Skaggs at 30. I've already begun that one. I mean, I'm not those ages anymore. And I want to add, thank God. But they are, you know, ages we've all been through. And the point of this is to do this as not coming-of-age stories, but awakening stories. What do we learn as a 7-year-old? What do we learn as an 18-year-old? What do we learn when we're 30? And the last one is when she's 45.
Well, a lot of people don't really process what they've learned and don't necessarily, kind of tend to repeat things that they did in earlier years and don't grow in the ways that they could or should. I, include myself in that sometimes, where I feel like I revert to, memories or things that happened to me, years ago. Sherry, your take on this?
I can't wait to go read it. She's got it available on her site that you can download it as a PDF. And I think this is a really interesting concept because one of my oft-repeated laments is, when am I going to grow up? When am I going to quit learning the lessons and start employing them?
Well, I think the thing about fiction is that it's not meant to be a... it's not meant to be something that you, as Skaggs says it at 18, she says, we were taught that when we read literature, there's supposed to be a message, and that our only job is to dissect the message. When in reality, it's to experience it. It's to experience how language affects us. And the deep emotional connection between language and the structure of a story.
Language... In a way, a moment ago, I was talking about language, and a DJ here, DJ Green Arrow, used the term that is often used in the rap world, word. Stephen Colbert uses it also. I mean, the idea that words and language is really important. We're now in the middle of this stupid debate about the rapper Common going to the White House for a poetry reading, and he's being, sort of indicted. On the basis of, kind of really specious criticisms. And, what is your take on that, Arrow?
Well, it's about completion of thought. And to tie into what you're saying, it's channeled material. When you're talking about that, it's a dialogue with your own subconscious. But it's you're channeling, you're not channeling God, you're channeling your material. And the same with Common, it's all, as Quincy Jones says, it's all the same 12 notes, whether you're talking about ODB, whether you're talking about you, it's all the same 12 notes.
Well, even the words, it's all note music.
All right, but still, the language, spoken word, and all of that, and the word is important. I just wanted to ask you one other thing, because I know it's something you've been concerned about. You recently got married. There's a big battle here in New York State about what some call same-sex marriage, others called marriage equality. How do you view this battle?
I don't think I'm all that different from most people who see it as a civil rights issue. I don't think of my love for my wife as being any less valid or important than the love that heterosexual couples feel. What bothers me about this whole debate is the people who consider themselves really well informed, and I'm just thinking about people like accountants, who don't realize that even though I'm married, and New York State recognizes my marriage, because of DOMA, I'm not allowed any of the same privileges that are allowed to a heterosexual couple. If people aren't willing to enter into this dialogue about civil rights for everybody, it's going to affect everything. It's going to affect health care. It's going to affect education. It's going to affect how every one of us view the military coming home from these horrible wars. Everything is affected by the same idea of equality.
Well, there you go. And on that note, I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
When we were on email, she said, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. I don't have anything to say. We can keep going here for another 10 hours, I'm sure, beating DJ Green Arrow's record, if necessary, in terms of language. Okay. Thank you, Kat, for being here. I know you didn't get to say much. Do you want to throw in a thought quickly, because we're running out of time?
I just want to say thank you for being here, and I appreciate the information, and hopefully it'll lead to something.
Okay, gang. On that note, we're going to say goodbye from News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here every week. You can follow me on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook. You can read the blog at newsdissector.com/blog every day if you're interested in my take on what's going on in the world. Thanking Sherry Welch for all of her help producing the show and also working with me and trying to reproduce our website so that they're accessible and professional and the like. I hope you'll be with us again next week at this time. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org if you have any thoughts, suggestions, and the like. That's it. Signing off. Thank you, PRN.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off, workers paid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops, and bank walking the AAA.